There lies concealed in the triad, says Stranoljubski, a vague image of the circumference controlling all life of the mind, and the mind is confined inescapably within it. This is truth's merry-go-round, for truth is always round. Consequently, in the development of life's forms, a certain pardonable curvature is possible, the hump of truth, but no more. Chernyshevsky's philosophy goes back through Feuerbach to the encyclopedists. On the other hand, applied Hegelianism, working gradually left, went through that same Feuerbach to join Marx, who in his Holy Family expresses himself thus: no great intelligence is needed to distinguish a connection between the teaching of materialism regarding inborn tendency to good, equality of man's capacities, capacities that generally are termed mental, the great influence exterior circumstances have on man, omnipotent experience, sway of habit and of upbringing, the extreme importance of industry, the moral right to pleasure, and communism. I have put it into blank verse so it would be less boring. Steklov is of the opinion that with all his genius, Chernyshevsky cannot rank with Marx, in relation to whom he stands as the Barnaul craftsman Polzunov stands to Watt. Marx himself, that petty bourgeois to the marrow of his bones, according to the testimony of Bakunin, who could not stand Germans, referred once or twice to the remarkable writings of Chernyshevsky. But he left more than one contemptuous note in the margins of the chief work on economics, Des großen russischen Gelehrten. Marx in general disliked Russians. Chernyshevsky repaid him in like coin. Already in the 70s, he was treating everything new with negligence, with malevolence. He was particularly fed up with economics, which had ceased to be a weapon for him, and by this token took on in his mind the aspect of an empty toy, of pure science. Lyatsky is quite wrong when, with a passion for navigational analogies common to many, he compares the exiled Chernyshevsky to a man watching from a deserted shore the passage of a gigantic ship, Marx's ship, on its way to discover new lands. The expression is especially unfortunate in view of the fact that Chernyshevsky himself, as if anticipating the analogy and wishing to refute it in advance, said of Das Kapital, sent to him in 1872, I glanced through but didn't read it. I tore off the pages one by one and made them into little ships, my italics, and launched them on the Vilui. Lenin considered Chernyshevsky to be the one truly great writer who managed to remain on a level of unbroken philosophical materialism from the 50s right up until 1888. He knocked 1 year off. Once on a windy day, Krupskaya turned to Lunacharsky and said to him with soft sorrow, there was hardly anyone Vladimir Ilyich liked so much. I think he had a great deal in common with Chernyshevsky. Yes, they undoubtedly had much in common, adds Lunacharsky, who had tended at first to treat this remark with skepticism. They had in common both clarity of style and mobility of speech, breadth and depth of judgment, revolutionary fire. That combination of enormous content with a modest exterior, and finally their joint moral makeup. Steklov calls Chernyshevsky's article, The Anthropological Principle in Philosophy, the first philosophical manifesto of Russian communism. It is significant that this first manifesto was a schoolboy's rendering, an infantile assessment of the most difficult moral questions. The European theory of materialism, says Stranoljubski, rephrasing Volinsky somewhat, took on with Chernyshevsky a simplified, muddled, and grotesque form. Passing scornful and impertinent judgment on Schopenhauer, under whose critical fingernail his own saltatory thinking would not have survived for a second, he recognized out of all former thinkers, by a strange association of ideas, and according to his mistaken memories, only Spinoza and Aristotle, whom he imagined himself to be continuing. Chernyshevsky hammered unsound syllogisms together. The moment he had gone, the syllogisms collapsed and the nails were left sticking out. In eliminating metaphysical dualism, he fell into gnosiological dualism, and having lightheartedly taken matter as the first principle, he got hopelessly lost among concepts presupposing something that creates our perception of the external world itself. The professional philosopher Yurkevich had no trouble at all in pulling him to pieces. Yurkevich kept wondering, how does Chernyshevsky account for the spatial motion of the nerves being transformed into non-spatial sensation? Instead of replying to the poor professor's detailed article, Chernyshevsky reprinted exactly a third of it in the Contemporary, that is, as much as was allowed by law, and broke it off in the middle of a word, with no comment. He most definitely did not give a hoot for the opinions of specialists, and he saw no harm in not knowing the details of the subject under examination. Details were for him merely the aristocratic element in the nation of our general ideas. His head thinks about the problems of humanity while his hand carries out unskilled labor, he wrote of his socially conscious workmen. And we cannot help recalling those woodcuts in ancient anatomical atlases where a pleasant-faced youth is depicted nonchalantly leaning against a column and showing the educated world all his viscera. But the political regime that was supposed to appear as the synthesis in the syllogism, where the thesis was the commune, resembled not so much Soviet Russia as the utopias of his day. The world of Fourier, the harmony of the 12 passions, the bliss of collective living, the rose-garlanded workmen, all this could not fail to please Chernyshevsky, who was always looking for coherency. Let us dream of the phalanstery living in a palace, 1,800 souls, and all happy. Music, flags, cakes. The world is run by mathematics, and well run at that. The correspondence which Fourier established between our desires and Newton's gravity was particularly captivating. It defined Chernyshevsky's attitude to Newton for all his life, and it is pleasant to compare the latter's apple with Fourier's apple, costing the commercial traveler a whole 14 sous in a Paris restaurant, a fact that led Fourier to ponder the basic disorder of the industrial mechanism, just as Marx was led to acquaint himself with economic problems by the question of the wine-making gnomes, small peasants, in the Moselle Valley, a graceful origination of grandiose ideas. While defending communal ownership of the land because of its simplifying the organization of associations in Russia, Chernyshevsky was prepared to agree to the emancipation of the peasants without land, the ownership of which would have led in the long run to new encumbrances. At this point, sparks flash from our pen. The liberation of the serfs. The era of great reforms. No wonder that in a burst of vivid prescience, the young Chernyshevsky noted in his diary in 1848, the year somebody dubbed the vent of the century, "What if we are indeed living in the times of Cicero and Caesar, when seculorum nobis nascitur ordo, and there comes a new Messiah, and a new religion, and a new world." The 50s are now in full fan. It is permitted to smoke on the streets. One may wear a beard. The overture to William Tell is thundered out on every musical occasion. Rumors spread that the capital is being moved to Moscow, that the old calendar is going to be replaced by the new. Under this cover, Russia is busily gathering material for Saltykov's primitive but juicy satire. "What is this talk of a new spirit in the air, I'd like to know," said General Zubatov. "Only the flunkies have grown rude. Otherwise, everything has stayed the way it was." Landowners, and notably their wives, began to dream terrible dreams not listed in dream books. A new heresy appeared. Nihilism. A scandalous and immoral doctrine rejecting everything that cannot be palpated, says Dahl with a shudder, in his definition of this strange word, in which nihil, nothing, corresponds, as it were, to material. Persons in holy orders had a vision. An enormous Chernyshevsky strides along the Nevsky Prospect, wearing a wide-brimmed hat and carrying a cudgel. And that first rescript in the name of the Vilna governor, Nazimov, and the Tsar's signature, so handsome, so robust, with two full-blooded mighty flourishes, which were to be later torn off by a bomb. And the ecstasy of Nikolai Gavrilovich, the blessing promised to the meek and the peacemakers, crowns Alexander II with a happiness which no other of Europe's sovereigns has yet known. But soon after the provincial committees were formed, Chernyshevsky's ardor cooled. He was incensed by the self-seeking of the nobles in most of them. His final disillusionment came in the second half of 1858. The size of the compensation, the smallness of the allotments. The tone of the contemporary became sharp and frank. The expressions infamous and infamy began pleasantly to enliven the pages of this dullish magazine. Its director's life was not rich in events. For a long time, the public did not know his face. Nowhere was he seen. Already famous, he remained, as it were, in the wings of his busy, talkative thought. Always, as was the custom then, in a dressing gown, spotted even behind with candle grease, he sat all day long in his little study with its blue wallpaper, good for the eyes, and its window overlooking the yard, a view of the log pile covered with snow, at a large desk heaped with books, printers' proofs, and cuttings. He worked so feverishly, smoked so much, and slept so little that the impression he produced was almost frightening. Skinny, nervy, his gaze at once blear and piercing, his hands shaky, his speech jerky and distracted. On the other hand, he never suffered from headache, and naively boasted of this as a mark of a healthy mind. His capacity for work was monstrous, as was for that matter that of most Russian critics of the last century. To his secretary, Studentsky, a former seminarist from Saratov, he dictated a translation of Schlosser's History, and in between, while the latter was taking it down, he himself would go on writing an article for the Contemporary, or would read something, making notes in the margins. He was pestered by callers. Not knowing how to escape from an importunate guest, he would, to his own chagrin, get more and more involved in a conversation. Leaning his elbow on the mantelpiece and fiddling with something, he would talk in a shrill, squeaky voice, but whenever his thoughts wandered, he would drawl and chew monotonously with an abundance of wells. He had a peculiar, quiet chuckle, causing Leo Tolstoy to break into a sweat, but when he laughed out loud, he went off into fits and roared deafeningly, at which Turgenev, hearing these roulades from afar, would take to his heels. Such methods of knowledge as dialectical materialism curiously resemble the unscrupulous advertisements for patent medicines which cure all illnesses at once. Still, such an expedient can occasionally help with a cold. There was quite definitively a smack of class arrogance about the attitudes of contemporary well-born writers toward plebeian Chernyshevsky. Turgenev, Grigorovich, and Tolstoy called him the bedbug-stinking gentleman, and among themselves jeered at him in all kinds of ways. Once at Turgenev's country place, the first two, together with Botkin and Druzhinin, composed and acted a domestic farce. In a scene where a couch was supposed to catch fire, Turgenev had to come out running with the cry. Here the common efforts of his friends had persuaded him to utter the unfortunate words which in his youth he had allegedly addressed to a sailor during a fire on board ship. Save me! Save me! I am my mother's only son! Out of this farce, the utterly talentless Grigorovich subsequently concocted his completely mediocre School of Hospitality, where he endowed one of the characters, the splenetic writer Chernushin, with the features of Nikolai Gavrilovich. Mole's eyes looking oddly askance, thin lips, a flattened, crumpled face, gingery hair fluffed up on the left temple, and a euphemistic stench of burnt rum. It is curious that the notorious wail, "Save me," etc., is attributed here to Chernushin, which gives color to Stranolyubsky's idea that there was a kind of mystic link between Turgenev and Chernyshevsky. "I have read his disgusting book, the dissertation," writes the former in a letter to his fellow mockers. "Raka, raka, raka. You know that there is nothing in the world more terrible than this Jewish curse." "This raka, or reka," remarks the biographer superstitiously, "resulted 7 years later in Rakeyev, the police colonel who arrested the anathematized man, and the letter itself had been written by Turgenev on precisely the 12th of July, Chernyshevsky's birthday." It seems to us that Stranolyubsky is stretching it a bit. That same year, Turgenev's Rudin appeared, but Chernyshevsky attacked it for its caricature of Bakunin only in 1860, when Turgenev was no longer necessary to the contemporary, which he had left as a result of Dobrolyubov's directing a snake hiss at his On the Eve. Tolstoy could not tolerate our hero. "One keeps hearing him," he wrote, "hearing that thin, nasty little voice of his saying obtuse, nasty things, as he keeps waxing indignant in his corner until someone says, 'Shut up,' and looks him in the eye." "The aristocrats turned into coarse ruffians," remarks Dekloff in this connection, "when they talked with inferiors or about people who were inferior to them socially." The inferior, however, did not remain in debt. Knowing how much Turgenev prized every word spoken against Tolstoy, Chernyshevsky in the 50s freely enlarged upon Tolstoy's poshlost, vulgarity, and chvastovstvo, bragging. The bragging of a thick-headed peacock about a tail which doesn't even cover his vulgar bottom, etc. "You are not some Ostrovsky or some Tolstoy," added Nikolai Gavrilovich. "You are an honor to us." And Rudin was already out, had been out for 2 years. The other literary reviews picked at him as much as they could. The critic Dudishkin in the National Commentator huffily aimed his Dudine at him. "Poetry for you is merely chapters of political economy transposed into verse." His ill-wishers in the mystical camp spoke about Chernyshevsky's evil lure, about his physical resemblance to the devil, for instance, Professor Kostomarov. Other journalists of a plainer cast, like Blagosvietlov, who considered himself a dandy and despite his radicalism had as footboy a real undyed blackamoor, talked about Chernyshevsky's dirty rubbers and German Comsexton's style of dress. Nekrasov stood up for the sensible fellow whom he had got for the contemporary, with a limp smile, admitting that he had managed to lay the stamp of monotony on the magazine by stuffing it with mediocre tales denouncing bribe-taking and policemen. But he praised his colleague for his fruitful labors. Thanks to him, the magazine had 4,700 subscribers in 1858, and 3 years later, 7,000. Nikolai Gavrilovich's relations with Nekrasov were friendly, but no more. There is a hint concerning some financial arrangements which displeased him. In 1883, in order to divert the old man, his cousin Pipin suggested that he should write some portraits of the past. Chernyshevsky depicted his first meeting with Nekrasov with the meticulousness and laboriousness already familiar to us, giving a complex plan of all their mutual movements about the room, including practically the number of footsteps, a detailism sounding like an insult inflicted on Father Time and his honest work, if one remembers that 30 years had elapsed since these maneuvers took place. He placed Nekrasov, the poet, above all others, above Pushkin, above Lermontov and Koltsov. La Traviata made Lenin weep. Similarly, Chernyshevsky, who confessed that poetry of the heart was even dearer to him than poetry of ideas, used to burst into tears over those of Nekrasov's verses, even iambic ones, which expressed everything he himself had experienced, all the torments of his youth, all the phases of his love for his wife. And no wonder. Nekrasov's iambic pentameter enchants us particularly by its hortatory, supplicatory, and prophetic force, and by a very individual caesura after the second foot, a caesura which in Pushkin, say, is a rudimentary organ, insofar as it controls the melody of the line, but which in Nekrasov becomes a genuine organ of breathing, as if it had turned from a partition into a pit, or as if the two-foot part of the line and the three-foot part had moved asunder, leaving, after the second foot, an interval full of music. As he listened to these hollow-chested verses, to this guttural, sobbing articulation, "Oh, do not say the life you lead is dismal, and do not call a jailer one half dead. Before me night yawns chilly and abysmal, the arms of love before you are outspread. I know to you another is now dearer. It irks you now to spare me and to wait. Oh, bear with me. My end is drawing nearer. Let fate complete what was begun by fate." Chernyshevsky could not help thinking that his wife should not hasten to deceive him, could not help identifying the nearness of the end with the shadow of the prison already stretching out toward him. And that was not all. Evidently, this connection was felt, not in the rational, but in the Orphic sense, also by the poet who wrote these lines. For it is precisely their rhythm, "Oh, do not say," that was echoed with a bizarre, haunting quality in the poem he subsequently wrote about Chernyshevsky. "Oh, do not say he has forgotten caution. For his own fate, himself, he'll be to blame." Thus, Nekrasov's sounds were pleasing to Chernyshevsky. That is, they happened to satisfy that elementary aesthetic for which he mistook all along his own circumstantial sentimentality. Having described a large circle, having taken in many matters concerning Chernyshevsky's attitude to various branches of knowledge, and yet not having impaired for a moment our smooth curve, we have now returned with new forces to his philosophy of art. Now it is time to sum it up. Like all the rest of our radical critics, having a weakness for easy gain, he eschewed courtly compliments to lady writers and energetically demolished Evdokia Rastopchin or Avdotya Glinka. An incorrect and careless patter, as Pushkin puts it, left him unmoved. Both he and Dobrolyubov flayed literary coquettes with gusto. But in real life, well, look what was done to them. Look how they were twisted and tortured with peals of laughter. Water nymphs laugh thus along streams flowing close to hermitages and other places of salvation, by the daughters of Dr. Vasiliev. His tastes were eminently solid. He was épaté by Hugo. He was impressed by Swinburne, which is not at all strange, come to think of it. In the list of books which he read in the fortress, the name of Flaubert is spelled with an O, and indeed he placed him below Zacher Masoch and Spielhagen. He loved Béranger the way average Frenchmen loved him. "For goodness sake," exclaimed Steklov, "you say that this man was not poetic? Why, do you not know that he would declaim Béranger and Relief with tears of rapture?" His tastes only congealed in Siberia, and by a strange delicacy of historical fate, Russia did not produce during the 20 years of his banishment a single genuine writer, until Chekhov, whose beginning he had not seen for himself during the active period of his life. From conversations with him in the 80s in Astrakhan, it becomes apparent that, yes, sir, it is the title of Count that made one consider Tolstoy a great writer of the Russian land. And when bothersome visitors asked him whom he thought the best living writer, he named a complete nonentity, Maxim Bielinsky. In his youth, he noted in his diary, political literature is the highest literature. In the 50s, when discussing at length Bielinsky, Vissarion, of course, something the government disapproved of, he followed him in saying that literature cannot fail to be the handmaiden of one or another ideological trend, and that writers incapable of being animated by sympathy toward what is being accomplished around us by the force of historical movement, will never in any circumstances produce anything great. For history does not know of any works of art that were created exclusively from the idea of beauty. In the 40s, Bielinsky maintained that George Sand can unconditionally be included in the role of European poets, in the German sense of Dichter, while the juxtaposition of Gogol's name with those of Homer and Shakespeare offends both decency and common sense. And that not only Cervantes, Walter Scott, and Cooper as artists preeminently, but also Swift, Sterne, Voltaire, and Rousseau have an incomparably and immeasurably greater significance in the whole history of literature than Gogol. Bielinsky was seconded 3 decades later by Chernyshevsky, when it is true George Sand had already ascended to the attic and Cooper had descended to the nursery, who said that Gogol is a very minor figure in comparison, for example, with Dickens or Fielding or Sterne. Poor Gogol. His exclamation, like Pushkin's, "Rus," is willingly repeated by the men of the 60s. But now the Troika needs paved highways, for even Russia's tasca, yearning, has become utilitarian. Poor Gogol. Esteeming the seminarist and the critic Nadezhdin, who used to write literature with 3 T's, Chernyshevsky found that his influence on Gogol would have been more beneficial than Pushkin's, and regretted that Gogol was not aware of such a thing as a principle. Poor Gogol. Why, that gloomy buffoon Father Matvey had also adjured him to renounce Pushkin. Lermontov came off luckier. His prose jerked from Bielinsky, who had a weakness for the conquests of technology, the surprising and most charming comparison of Pechorin to a steam engine, shattering all who were careless enough to get under its wheels. In his poetry, the middle-class intellectuals felt something of the socio-lyrical strain that later came to be called Nadsonism. In this sense, Lermontov was the first Nadson of Russian literature. The rhythm, the tone, the pale, tear-diluted idiom of civic verse, up to and including "As victims you fell in the fateful contest," the famous revolutionary song of the first years of our century, all of this goes back to such Lermontov lines as, "Farewell, our dear comrade. Alas, upon earth not long did you dwell, blue-eyed singer. A plain cross of wood you have earned, and with us your memory always shall linger." Lermontov's real magic, the melting vistas in his poetry, its paradisial picturesqueness, and the transparent tang of the celestial in his moist verse, these, of course, were completely inaccessible to the understanding of men of Chernyshevsky's stamp. Now we're approaching his most vulnerable spot. But it has long become customary to measure the degree of flair, intelligence, and talent of a Russian critic by his attitude to Pushkin. And this is how it will remain until Russian literary criticism discards its sociological, religious, philosophical, and other textbooks which only help mediocrity to admire itself. Only then will you be free to say what you please. You may then criticize Pushkin for any betrayals of his exigent muse, and at the same time preserve both your talent and your honor. Upbraid him for letting one hexameter creep into the pentameters of Boris Godunov, ninth scene, for a metrical error in the 21st line of the feast during the plague, for repeating the phrase every minute, pominutno, five times within 16 lines in the blizzard. But for God's sake, stop that irrelevant chit-chat. Stranolyubsky sagaciously compares the critical utterances of the 60s concerning Pushkin with the attitude to him 3 decades earlier of the chief of police Count Benkendorf, or that of the director of the third section, von Fock. In truth, Chernyshevsky's highest praise for a writer, like that of the ruler Nicholas I or the radical Bielinsky, was sensible. When Chernyshevsky or Pisarev called Pushkin's poetry rubbish and luxury, they were only repeating Tolmachov, author of Military Eloquence, who in the 30s had termed the same subject trifles and baubles. When Chernyshevsky said that Pushkin was only a poor imitator of Byron, he reproduced with monstrous accuracy the definition given by Count Vorontsov, Pushkin's boss in Odessa, a poor imitator of Lord Byron. Dobrolyubov's favorite idea that Pushkin lacked a solid, deep education is in friendly chime with Vorontsov's remark, "One cannot be a genuine poet without constantly working to broaden one's knowledge, and his is insufficient." "To be a genius, it is not enough to have manufactured Eugene Onegin," wrote the progressive Nadezhdin, comparing Pushkin to a tailor, an inventor of waistcoat patterns, and thus concluding an intellectual pact with the reactionary Count Uvarov, Minister of Education, who remarked on the occasion of Pushkin's death, "To write jingles does not mean yet to achieve a great career." Chernyshevsky equated genius with common sense. If Pushkin was a genius, he argued perplexedly, then how should one interpret the profusion of corrections in his drafts? One can understand some polishing in a fair copy, but this was the rough work itself. It should have flowed effortless, since common sense speaks its mind immediately, for it knows what it wants to say. Moreover, as a person ridiculously alien to artistic creation, he supposed that polishing took place on paper, while the real work, that is, the task of forming the general plan, occurred in the mind. Another sign of that dangerous dualism, that crack in his materialism, whence more than one snake was to slither and bite him during his life. Pushkin's originality filled him with fears. Poetic works are good when everyone, my italics, says after reading them, "Yes, this is not only verisimilar, but also it could not be otherwise, for that's how it always is." Pushkin does not figure in the list of books sent to Chernyshevsky at the fortress, and no wonder. Despite Pushkin's services, he invented Russian poetry and taught society to read it, two statements completely untrue. He was nevertheless, above all, a writer of witty little verses about women's little feet. And little feet, in the intonation of the 60s, when the whole of nature had been philistinized into travka, diminutive of grass, and pichushki, diminutive of birds, already meant something quite different from Pushkin's petit pied, something that had now become closer to the mawkish füßchen. It seemed particularly astonishing to him, as it did also to Bielinsky, that Pushkin became so aloof toward the end of his life. An end was put to those friendly relations whose monument has remained the poem Arion, explains Chernyshevsky in passing. But how full of sacred meaning was this casual reference to the forbidden subject of Decembrism for the reader of the contemporary, whom we suddenly imagine as absent-mindedly and hungrily biting into an apple, transferring the hunger of his reading to the apple, and again eating the words with his eyes. Therefore, Nikolai Gavrilovich must have been more than a little irritated by a stage direction in the penultimate scene of Boris Godunov, a stage direction resembling a sly hint and an encroachment upon civic laurels hardly deserved by the author of vulgar drivel. See Chernyshevsky's remarks on the poem Stamboul is by the Giaours now lauded. Pushkin comes surrounded by the people. Reading over the most abusive critics, wrote Pushkin during an autumn at Baldino, I find them so amusing that I don't understand how I could have been angry at them. Meseems if I wanted to laugh at them, I could think of nothing better than just to reprint them with no comment at all. Curiously enough, that is exactly what Chernyshevsky did with Professor Yurkevich's article, a grotesque repetition. And now, a revolving speck of dust has got caught in a ray of Pushkin's light, which has penetrated between the blinds of Russian critical thought, to use Stranolyubsky's caustic metaphor. We have in mind the following magic gamut of fate. In his Saratov diary, Chernyshevsky applied two lines from Pushkin's The Egyptian Nights to his courtship, completely misquoting the second one, with a characteristic, for him who had no ear, distortion. He met the challenge of delight as warfare's challenge met I'd have, instead of as he would meet in days of war the challenge of a savage battle. For this I'd have. Fate, the ally of the muses and herself an expert in conditional forms, took revenge on him. And with what refined stealth in the evolution of the punishment. What connection, it seems, could there be between this ill-starred misquotation and Chernyshevsky's remark 10 years later, in 1862, if people were able to announce all their ideas concerning public affairs at meetings, there would be no need to make magazine articles out of them. However, at this point, Nemesis is already awakening. Instead of writing, one would speak, continues Chernyshevsky. And if these ideas had to reach everyone who had not taken part in the meeting, they could be noted down by a stenographer. And vengeance unfolds. In Siberia, where his only listeners were the larches and the yakuts, he was haunted by the image of a platform and a lecture hall, in which it was so convenient for the public to gather, and where the latter would ripple so responsively. For, in the final analysis, he, as Pushkin's improvisatore, he of the Egyptian Nights, but a poorer versificator, had chosen for his profession, and later as an unrealizable ideal, variations on a given theme. In the very twilight of his life, he composes a work in which he embodies his dream. From Astrakhan, not long before his death, he sends Lavrov his Evenings at the Princess Starobielsky's for the literary review Russian Thought, which did not find it possible to print them, and follows this up with an insertion addressed straight to the printer. In that part where it says that the people have gone from the salon dining room into the salon proper, which has been prepared for them to listen to Vyazovsky's fairy tale, and there is a description of the arrangement of the auditorium, the distribution of the male and female stenographers into two sections at two tables either is not indicated or else is indicated unsatisfactorily. In my draft, this part reads as follows. Along the sides of the platform stood two tables for the stenographers. Vyazovsky went up to the stenographers, shook hands with them, and stood chatting with them while the company took their places. The lines in the fair copy, whose sense corresponds to the passage quoted from my draft, should be replaced now by the following lines. The men, forming a constricted frame, stood near the stage and along the walls behind the last chairs. The musicians, with their stands, occupied both sides of the stage. The improvisatore, greeted by deafening applause rising from all sides. Sorry, we've mixed everything up. Got hold of an extract from Pushkin's The Egyptian Nights. Let us restore the situation. Between the platform and foremost hemicycle of the auditorium, writes Chernyshevsky to a non-existent printer, a little to the right and left of the platform stood two tables. At the one which was on the left in front of the platform, if you look from the middle of the hemicycles toward the platform, etc., etc., with many more words of the same sort, none of them really expressing anything. Here is a theme for you, said Charsky to the improvisatore. The poet himself chooses the subjects for his poems. The multitude has no right to direct his inspiration. We've been led a long way by the impetus and revolution of the Pushkin theme in Chernyshevsky's life. Meanwhile, a new character, whose name once or twice has already burst impatiently into our discourse, is awaiting his entrance. Now it is just time for him to appear, and here he comes in the tightly buttoned, blue-collared regulation coat of a university student, fairly reeking of chestnut, progressive principle, ungainly, with tiny, short-sighted eyes and a scanty Newport frill, that barbe en collier which seems so symptomatic to Flaubert. He offers his hand jab-wise, that is, thrusting it oddly forward with the thumb turned out, and introduces himself in a catarrhally confidential little bass, Dobrolyubov. Their first meeting, summer 1856, was recalled almost 30 years later by Chernyshevsky, when he also wrote about Nekrasov, with his familiar wealth of detail. Essentially sickly and impotent, but supposed to set off the irreproachability of thought in its transactions with time. Friendship joined these two men in a monogrammatic union which 100 centuries are incompetent to untie. On the contrary, it becomes even faster in the consciousness of posterity. This is not the place to enlarge upon the literary activities of the younger man. Let us merely say that he was uncouthly crude and uncouthly naive. That in the satirical review The Whistle, he poked fun at the distinguished Dr. Pirogov while parodying Lermontov. The use of some of Lermontov's lyrical poems as a canvas for journalistic jokes about people and events was in general so widespread that in the long run it turned into a caricature of the very art of parody. Let us say also, in Stranolyubsky's words, that from the push given it by Dobrolyubov, literature rolled down an inclined plane, with the inevitable result, once it had rolled to zero, that it was put into inverted commas. The student brought some literature, meaning propaganda leaflets. What else can one add? Dobrolyubov's humor? Oh, those blessed times when mosquito was in itself funny. A mosquito settling on someone's nose twice as funny. And a mosquito flying into a governmental office and biting a civil servant caused the listeners to groan and double up with laughter. Much more engaging than Dobrolyubov's obtuse and ponderous critique, all this pleiad of radical critics, in fact, wrote with their feet, is the frivolous side of his life, that feverish, romantic sportiveness which subsequently supplied Chernyshevsky with material for the love intrigues of Levitsky in the prologue. Dobrolyubov was extraordinarily prone to falling in love. Here we catch a glimpse of him playing assiduously Durachki, a simple card game, with a much-decorated general whose daughter he courts. He had a German girl in Stara Yerusa, a strong, onerous tie. From immoral visits to her, Chernyshevsky held him back in the full sense of the word. For a long time they would wrestle, both of them limp, scrawny, and sweaty, toppling all over the floor, colliding with the furniture, all the time silent. All you could hear was their wheezing. Then, stumbling into one another, they would both search for their spectacles beneath the upturned chairs. At the beginning of 1859, gossip reached Chernyshevsky that Dobrolyubov, just like Dantès, in order to cover his intrigue with Olga Sokratovna, wanted to marry her sister, who already had a fiancé. Both the young women played outrageous tricks on Dobrolyubov. They took him to masked balls dressed as a capuchin or an ice cream vendor and confided all their secrets in him. Walks with Olga Sokratovna completely bemused him. I know there is nothing to be gained here, he wrote to a friend, because not a single conversation goes by without her mentioning that, although I am a good man, nevertheless I am too clumsy and almost repulsive. I understand that I should not try to gain anything anyway, since in any case I am fonder of Nikolai Gavrilovich than of her. But at the same time, I am powerless to leave her alone. When he heard the gossip, Nikolai Gavrilovich, who entertained no illusions concerning his wife's morals, still felt some resentment. The betrayal was a double one. He and Dobrolyubov had a frank explanation, and soon afterwards he sailed to London to maul Herzen, as he subsequently expressed it, that is, to give him a good scolding for his attacks on that same Dobrolyubov in the Kolokol, the Bell, a liberal periodical published abroad, but of less radical views than the endemic contemporary. Perhaps, however, the object of this meeting was not only to intercede for his friend. Dobrolyubov's name, especially later in connection with his death, Chernyshevsky very skillfully handled as a matter of revolutionary tactics. According to certain reports from the past, his main object in visiting Herzen was to discuss the publishing of the contemporary abroad. Everyone had a premonition that soon it would be closed down. But in general, this trip is surrounded with such a haze and has left so few traces in Chernyshevsky's writings that one would almost prefer, in spite of the facts, to consider it apocryphal. He who had always been interested in England, he who had nourished his soul on Dickens and his mind on The Times, how avidly he should have gulped it down, how many impressions he should have garnered, how insistently he should later have kept turning back to it in memory. Actually, Chernyshevsky never spoke of his journey, and whenever anyone really pressed him, he would reply briefly, "Well, what's there to talk about? There was fog, the ship rocked, what else could there be?" Thus, life itself, how many times now, refuted his axiom. The tangible object acts much more strongly than the abstract concept of it. However that may have been, on the 26th June, new style, 1859, Chernyshevsky arrived in London. Everyone thought that he was in Saratov, and stayed there until the 30th. An oblique ray pierces the fog of these 4 days. Madame Tuchkov-Ogaryov walks through a drawing room and into a sunny garden, carrying in her arms her year-old baby girl, dressed in a little lace pelerine. In the drawing room, the action takes place in Putney at Herzen's house, Alexander Ivanovich is walking back and forth. These indoor walks were very much the thing in those days, with a gentleman of medium height, whose face is unattractive, but illumined by a wonderful expression of self-abnegation and submissiveness to fate, which most likely was merely a trick of the memoirist's memory, recalling that face through the prism of the fate which had already been accomplished. Herzen introduced his companion to her. Chernyshevsky stroked the infant's hair and said in his quiet voice, "I also have some like this, but I hardly ever see them." He used to confuse the names of his children. Little Victor was in Saratov, where he soon died, for the fate of children does not forgive such slips of the pen. But he sent a kiss to little Sasha, who had already been brought back to St. Petersburg. "Say, how do you do?" "Give us your hand," said Herzen rapidly, and then immediately began to reply to something that had been said by Chernyshevsky. "Yes, exactly. That's why they sent them to the Siberian mines." While Madame Tuchkov floated into the garden, and the oblique ray was extinguished forever. Diabetes and nephritis, added to tuberculosis, soon put an end to Dobrolyubov. He was dying in the late autumn of 1861. Chernyshevsky paid him a daily call, and from there went about his conspiratorial affairs, which were amazingly well concealed from police spies. It is generally considered that he was the author of the proclamation to the serfs of landowners. "There was not much talk," recalls Shelgunov, who wrote the one to the soldiers. and evidently not even Vladislav Kostomarov, who printed these appeals, knew with any certainty about Chernyshevsky's authorship. Their style is very reminiscent of Count Rostopchin's corny little placards against Napoleon's invasion. So this is what it comes to, this thorough, true freedom. And let courts be just, and let all be alike before justice. And what's the sense of kicking up a ruction in one village only? If this was written by Chernyshevsky, incidentally, Bulgar, ruction, is a vulgar word, it was in any case touched up by someone else. According to information stemming from the People's Freedom Organization, Chernyshevsky suggested to Sleptsov and his friends in July 1861 that they form a basic cell of five, the nucleus of an underground society. The system consisted in every member forming, moreover, his own cell, and thus knowing only eight people. Only the center knew all the members. All the members were known only to Chernyshevsky. This account does not seem free from some stylization. But let us repeat, he was ideally cautious. After the student disorders of October 1861, he was put under permanent surveillance, but the agent's work was not distinguished for its subtlety. Nikolai Gavrilovich had as a cook the wife of the house janitor, a tall, red-cheeked old woman with a somewhat unexpected name, Musa. She was bribed with no trouble, 5 rubles for coffee, to which she was much addicted. In return, Musa used to supply the police with the contents of her employer's wastebasket. Meanwhile, on November 17, 1861, at 25 years of age, Dobrolyubov died. He was buried in the Volkov Cemetery in a simple oak coffin. The coffin in such cases is always simple, next to Bielinsky. Suddenly there stepped forth an energetic, clean-shaven gentleman, recalls a witness. Chernyshevsky's appearance was still unfamiliar, and since few people had gathered and this irritated him, he started to speak of it with detailed irony. While he was speaking, Olga Sokratovna shook with tears, leaning upon the arm of one of those devoted students who were always with her. Another, besides his own regulation cap, held the raccoon cap of the boss, who, with his fur coat unbuttoned, in spite of the frost, took out an exercise book and began in an angry, didactic voice to read from it Dobrolyubov's lumpy gray poems about honest principles and approaching death. Hoarfrost shone on the birches, and a little to one side, next to the doddering mother of one of the gravediggers, in new felt boots and full of humility, stood an agent of the secret police. Yes, concluded Chernyshevsky, we are not concerned here with the fact that the censorship, by cutting his articles to bits, brought Dobrolyubov to a disease of the kidneys. For his own glory, he did enough. For his own sake, he had no reason to live longer. For men of such a caste and with such aspirations, life has nothing but burning grief to offer. Honest principles, that was his fatal illness. And pointing with his rolled-up notebook to an adjacent empty place on the other side, Chernyshevsky exclaimed, "There is not a man in Russia worthy of occupying that grave." There was. It was occupied soon afterwards by Pisarev. It is difficult to escape the impression that Chernyshevsky, who in his youth had dreamed of being the leader of a national uprising, was now reveling in the rarefied air of danger surrounding him. This significance in the secret life of his country he acquired inevitably by agreement with his epoch, a family likeness with which he himself realized. Now it seemed he needed only a day, only an hour's run of luck in the game of history, one moment of passionate union between chance and destiny in order to soar. A revolution was expected in 1863, and in the cabinet of the future constitutional government he was listed as prime minister. How he nursed that precious ardor within him. That mysterious something which Steklov talks about in spite of his Marxism and which was extinguished in Siberia, although learning and logic and even implacability remained, undoubtedly existed in Chernyshevsky and manifested itself with unusual strength just before his banishment to Siberia. Magnetic and dangerous, it was this that frightened the government far more than any proclamations. This demented gang is thirsting for blood, for outrages, excitedly said the reports. Deliver us from Chernyshevsky. Desolation, lone mountain ranges, a myriad lakes and marshes, a shortage of the most essential things, inefficient postmasters. All this exhausts even the patience of genius. This is what he had copied into the Contemporary from the geographer Sielski's book on the Yakutsk province, thinking of certain things, supposing certain things, perhaps having a presentiment. In Russia, the censorship department arose before literature. Its fateful seniority has been always in evidence. And what an urge to give it a tweak. Chernyshevsky's activities on the Contemporary turned into a voluptuous mockery of the censorship, which unquestionably was one of our country's most remarkable institutions. And right then, at a time when the authorities were fearful, for example, lest musical notes should conceal anti-governmental writings in code, and so commissioned well-paid experts to decode them, Chernyshevsky in his magazine, under the cover of elaborate clowning, was frenziedly promulgating Feuerbach. Whenever in articles about Garibaldi or Cavour, one shrinks from computing the miles of small print this indefatigable man translated from the Times, in his commentaries on Italian events, he kept adding in brackets with drilling insistence after practically every other sentence, Italy, in Italy, I am talking about Italy. The already corrupted reader knew that he meant he was talking about Russia and the peasant question. Or else, Chernyshevsky would pretend he was chattering about anything that came to mind just for the sake of incoherent and vacant prattle, but suddenly, striped and spotted with words, dressed in verbal camouflage, the important idea he wished to convey would slip through. Subsequently, the whole gamut of this buffoonery was carefully put together by Vladislav Kostomarov for the information of the secret police. The work was mean, but it gave essentially a true picture of Chernyshevsky's special devices. Another Kostomarov, a professor, says somewhere that Chernyshevsky was a first-rate chess player. Actually, neither Kostomarov nor Chernyshevsky knew much about chess. In his youth, it is true, Nikolai Gavrilovich once bought a set, attempted even to master a handbook, managed more or less to learn the moves, and messed about with it for quite a time, noting this messing about in detail. Finally, tiring of this empty pastime, he turned over everything to a friend. 15 years later, remembering that Lessing had got to know Mendelssohn over a chessboard, he founded the St. Petersburg Chess Club, which was opened in January 1862, existed through spring, gradually declining, and would have failed of itself had it not been closed down in connection with the St. Petersburg fires. It was simply a literary and political circle situated in the so-called Ruadze House. Chernyshevsky would come and sit at a table, tapping upon it with a rook, which he called a castle, and relate innocuous anecdotes. The radical Serna Soloviovich would arrive, this is a Turgenevian dash, and strike up a conversation with someone in a secluded corner. It was fairly empty. The drinking fraternity, the minor writers Pomyalovsky, Kurochkin, Kroll, would vociferate in the bar. The first, by the way, did a little preaching of his own, promoting the idea of communal literary work. Let's organize, he said, a society of writer laborers for investigating various aspects of our social life, such as beggars, haberdashers, lamplighters, firemen, and pool in a special magazine all the material we get. Chernyshevsky derided him, and a silly rumor went around to the effect that Pomyalovsky had bashed his mug in. It's all lies. I respect you too much for that, wrote Pomyalovsky to him. In a large auditorium situated in that same Ruadze house, there took place, on March 2, 1862, Chernyshevsky's first, if you do not count his dissertation defense and the graveside speech in the frost, public address. Officially, the proceeds of the evening were to go to needy students, but in actual fact, it was in aid of the political prisoners Mikhailov and Obruchev, who had recently been arrested. Rubinstein brilliantly performed an extremely stirring march. Professor Pavlov spoke of Russia's millennium, and added ambiguously that if the government stopped at the first step, the emancipation of the peasants, it would stop on the brink of an abyss. Let those with ears to hear, hear. They heard him. He was immediately expulsed. Nekrasov read some poor but powerful verses dedicated to the memory of Dobrolyubov, and Kurochkin read a translation of Béranger's The Little Bird, the captive's languishment and the rapture of sudden freedom. Chernyshevsky's speech was also on Dobrolyubov. Greeted with massive applause, the youth of those days had a way of keeping their palms hollowed while they clapped so that the result resembled a cannon salvo, he stood for a while, blinking and smiling. Alas, his appearance did not please the ladies eagerly awaiting the tribune, whose portrait was unobtainable. An uninteresting, they said, face, haircut à la mujique, and for some reason wearing not tails but a short coat with braid and a horrible tie, a color catastrophe. Olga Ryshkov, A Woman of the 60s, Memoirs. Besides that, he came somehow unprepared. Oratory was new to him, and trying to conceal his agitation, he adopted a conversational tone which seemed too modest to his friends and too familiar to his ill-wishers. He began by talking about his briefcase, from which he took a notebook, explaining that the most remarkable part of it was the lock with a small cogwheel. Look, you give it a turn and the briefcase is locked. And if you want to lock it even more positively, it turns a different way, and then comes off and goes in your pocket. And on the spot where it was, here on this plaque, there are carved arabesques. Very, very nice. Then, in a high, edifying voice, he started to read an article by Dobrolyubov that everybody knew, but suddenly broke off and, as in the authorial digressions in What to Do, chummily taking the audience into his confidence, began to explain in great detail that he had not been Dobrolyubov's guide. While speaking, he played ceaselessly with his watch chain, something that stuck in the minds of all the memoirists and was to provide a theme for scoffing journalists. But when you come to think of it, he might have been fiddling with his watch, because there was indeed very little free time left to him, 4 months in all. His tone of voice, negligé with spirit, as they used to say in the seminary, and the complete absence of revolutionary insinuations, annoyed his audience. He had no success whatsoever, while Pavlov was almost chaired. The memoirist Nikoladze remarks that as soon as Pavlov had been banished from St. Petersburg, people understood and appreciated Chernyshevsky's caution. He himself, subsequently in his Siberian wilderness, where a live and avid auditorium appeared to him sometimes only in febrile dreams, keenly regretted that lame speech, that fiasco, repining at himself for not having seized that unique opportunity, since he was in any case doomed to ruin, and not delivering from that lectern in the Ruadze Hall a speech of iron and fire, that very speech which the hero of his novel was about to give, very likely, when upon returning to freedom he took a droshky and cried to the driver, "The galleries!" Events went very fast that windy spring. Fires broke out here and there. And suddenly, against this orange and black background, a vision. Running and holding on to his hat, Dostoevsky sweeps by. Where to? Whit Monday, May 28, 1862. A strong wind is blowing. A conflagration has begun on the Ligovka, and then the desperados set fire to the Apraxin Palace. Dostoevsky is running, firemen are galloping, and in pharmacy windows in gaudy glass globes upside down are in passing reflected, as seen by Nekrasov. And over there, thick smoke billows over the Fontanka Canal in the direction of Chernyshov Street, where presently a new black column arises. Meanwhile, Dostoevsky has arrived. He has arrived at the heart of the blackness, at Chernyshevsky's place, and starts to beg him hysterically to put a stop to all this. Two aspects are interesting here. The belief in Nikolai Gavrilovich's satanic powers and the rumors that the arson was being carried out according to the same plan which the Petrashevskians had drawn up as early as 1849. Secret agents, in tones also not void of mystic horror, reported that during the night at the height of the disaster, laughter was heard coming from Chernyshevsky's window. The police endowed him with a devilish resourcefulness and smelled a trick in his every move. Nikolai Gavrilovich's family went to spend the summer at Pavlovsk, a few miles from St. Petersburg, and there, a few days after the fires, on June 10th to be precise, dusk, mosquitoes, music, a certain Lyubetsky, adjutant major of the Uhlan Regiment of the Guards, a dashing fellow with a name like a kiss, noticed as he was leaving the Vauxhall two ladies capering about like mad things, and in the simpleness of his heart taking them for young camellias, loose women, he made an attempt to grasp them both by the waist. The four students who were with them surrounded him and threatened him with retribution, announcing that one of the ladies was the wife of the writer Chernyshevsky and the other her sister. What, in the opinion of the police, is the husband's design? He tries to get the case to be submitted to the court of the Officers' Association, not out of considerations of honor, but merely for the clandestine purpose of bringing military men and university students together. On July 5th, he had to visit the secret police department in connection with his complaint. Potapov, its chief, refused his petition, saying that according to his information, the Uhlan was prepared to apologize. Chernyshevsky curtly renounced any claims, and changing the subject, asked, "Tell me, the other day I sent my family off to Saratov and am preparing myself to go there for arrest." The contemporary had already been closed. "But if I should need to take my wife abroad, to a spa, you see she suffers from nervous pains, could I leave without hindrance?" "Of course you could," replied Potapov good-naturedly. And 2 days later, the arrest took place. All this was preceded by the following event. A universal exhibition has just opened in London. The 19th century was unusually fond of exhibiting its wealth, a plentiful and tasteless dowry which the present one has squandered. Gathered there were tourists and merchants, correspondents and spies. One day, at an enormous banquet, Herzen, in a fit of carelessness, in view of everyone, handed a certain Vyetushnikov, who was preparing to leave for Russia, a letter to the radical journalist Serna Solovyevich, who was asked to direct Chernyshevsky's attention to the announcement made in the Bell concerning its willingness to publish the contemporary abroad. The nimble foot of the messenger had hardly had time to touch Russia's sands when he was seized. Chernyshevsky was then living near the Church of St. Vladimir. Later his Astrakhan addresses were also defined by their proximity to this or that holy building. In a house where before him had lived Muravyov, later a cabinet minister, whom he was to depict with such helpless loathing in the prologue. On July 7th, two friends had come to see him. Dr. Bokov, who subsequently used to send medical advice to the exile, and Antonovich, a member of Land and Freedom, who, in spite of his close friendship with Chernyshevsky, did not suspect that the latter was connected with that society. They were sitting in the drawing room, where they were presently joined by Colonel Rakeyev, a thick-set, black-uniformed police officer with an unpleasant, wolfish profile. He sat down with the air of a guest. Actually, he had come to arrest Chernyshevsky. Again, historical patterns come into that odd contact which thrills the gamester in a historian, Stranolyubsky. This was the same Rakeyev who, as an embodiment of the government's contemptible scurry, had whisked Pushkin's coffin out of the capital into posthumous exile. Having chatted a few minutes, for the sake of decorum, Rakeyev informed Chernyshevsky with a polite smile, which caused Dr. Bokov to turn chill inside, that he would like to have a word with him alone. "Then let's go to my study," replied the latter, and headed for it so precipitately that Rakeyev, though not exactly disconcerted, he was too experienced for that, did not consider it possible in his role of guest to follow him with equal speed. But Chernyshevsky immediately returned, his Adam's apple convulsively bobbing as he washed something down with cold tea. Swallowed papers, according to Antonovich's sinister guess. And looking over his spectacles, he let his guest enter first. His friends, having nothing better to do, waiting in the drawing-room where most of the furniture was shrouded in dust covers seemed uncommonly bleak, went out for a stroll. "It can't be, I can't believe it," Volkov kept repeating. And when they returned to the house, the fourth in Bolshoi Moskovsky Street, they were alarmed to see that there now stood at the door in a kind of meek and thus all the more loathsome expectation, a prison carriage. First, Bokov went in to say goodbye to Chernyshevsky, then Antonovich. Nikolai Gavrilovich was sitting at his desk playing with a pair of scissors while the colonel sat next to it, one leg folded over the other. They were chatting, still for the sake of decorum, about the advantages of Pavlovsk over other holiday areas. "And then the company there is so excellent," the colonel was saying with a slight cough. "What? You two are going without waiting for me?" said Chernyshevsky, turning to his apostle. "Unfortunately, I have to," replied Antonovich in deep confusion. "Well, goodbye, then," said Nikolai Gavrilovich in a joking tone of voice, and lifting his hand high, he lowered it with a swoop into Antonovich's, a type of comradely farewell which subsequently became very widespread among Russian revolutionaries. "And so," exclaims Stranoyubsky at the beginning of the greatest chapter in his incomparable monograph, "Chernyshevsky has been seized."